Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 116 of season 11 of Movie Room Minute, the daily podcast where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off his three-episode stint is Joe Mucha, a veteran, a battlefield tour guide, a historian, and podcaster. Welcome back once again, Joe.
It's great to be back, Rob. I can't wait to do this one.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. This is, you know, the way things are just moving along. Just great. So, episode 116 begins with Webster continuing to scream and ends with the men continuing to move through the woods.
This is going to be a very interesting one. It's a very heavy segment, but I think there's lots of stuff. I think we talked in our previous episode about like the writers and the getting it right, and the actors getting it right. They get a lot right in this one.
Yeah, it's true. And so we basically ended things yesterday with the men of Easy and all the other allied troops, moving towards moving deeper into Germany, as we saw the German army retreating backwards at the same time. And Webster stood up in the back of his truck and started screaming. And he continues today by saying, "That's right, you stupid crop bastards. That's right. Say hello to Ford and General Motors, you stupid fascist pigs. Look at you. You have horses. What were you thinking?"
And the guy
next to him just goes, "That's enough, Webster. Give it a rest."
Yeah.
And Webster goes, "Dragging our asses halfway around the world, interrupting our lives. For what? You ignorant, servile scum. What the fuck are you doing here?"
Yeah. Beautiful hat tip to Webster's command of the language, first of all.
Yes.
You know, servile is not a word you usually hear coming out of a GI's mouth.
No.
So very interesting.
Well, he was at Harvard, you know. So.
Yeah. But really, the most interesting part of his tirade is the Ford and General Motors comments. And we kind of see this in this scene, you know, when you get that first panning sequence where they're looking over the overpass. And you see them, the German army in defeat, walking and using horse-bound carts and carriages. And then all the mechanized U.S. Army just flowing in the opposite direction. And this is something that is had a bearing on the German war machine for years. Their lack of motorized transport, the fact that they use so many horses. And what the interesting part was, the Germans really kind of spearheaded mechanized warfare early in the war, but they never advanced past their lead elements being mechanized. Their logistics and support elements continued to be horse-drawn, and a lot of their artillery continued to be horse-drawn, and in some cases their infantry were bicycle-borne. This cannot compete with the American way of conducting operations. And the Americans had a very steep learning curve from early on in the war. And by the time we get into 1945 and they're in Germany, mechanized warfare is the way that the U.S. Army, that and prolific use of artillery and air, really come into play. But it's really neatly encapsulated in his comments on a commentary about the differences between the two armies.
Again, it's great the way that they show this, because this is basically the first time that we noticed something like this. You know, I mean, we did have the guy on the horseback, but that was, you know, traveling through the woods of Belgium. So it's a little different.
Yeah. But this is, yeah, like you said, this is where they show the greatest disparity between the two. From the individual soldier, you're probably not going to see it. Like, he's not going to notice it unless they're a very keen observer on the battlefield and they notice all the horses that keep getting slaughtered in the different engagements. And a lot of the guys did comment about, like, they would, you know, after an ambush or whatever, they'd see, like German horses are part of the landscape. But this is where they really hammer it home visually.
Yeah,
And I
for sure.
thought they did a spectacular job here in showing it.
Right. Especially since they're showing it as things are, up until now, there's been a lot of fighting between, the Allies and the Germans. And you see, they make it seem as if everything is completely on the same level. It's a level playing field. And now they're starting to show us that, wait a second, this wasn't a level playing field.
No, especially by 1945. Now, while you can say that the British were kind of tapped out in manpower, the Americans were also starting to feel the strain of the ability to man and equip divisions for this assault into Germany. But no one felt it more than the Germans because they have millions and millions of death. They're losing, I don't know how many people at a day on the Eastern Front, and you have the Western Allies, punching into them from the Western side. They're the strain in manpower. You're seeing it in terms of the amount of kids and seniors in the ranks by this time of the war as well, for age 14, 15. My buddy Rob's grandfather served in the European theater, and he mentioned how when they were advancing into Germany, they actually captured a couple of SS youths who were shooting at them. And instead of killing them, they basically spanked them because
Oh, wow.
they were kids. They weren't even older teenagers. They were younger teenagers. So it was very the disparity in so many aspects of land warfare at this point in time in 1945. It's just the Germans are completely behind the power curve.
Yeah, which makes you wonder why, how they thought that they were still able to, conquer all of Europe with using that. I guess, I mean, obviously they had something that helped them help them do that, but I think you could say they didn't have the deep roster to be able to work on it. And I think
Well,
that's sort of.
you look at the opponents at the time, and none of them were really mechanized either. Most of the armies in late 39 and early 1940 are fighting World War I style, and the Germans have advanced past that in terms of their mechanization. So, but by the time 45 rolls around, the Germans have been overrun in that regard. The concept of mechanized warfare.
It's true. And then we're back watching watching them continue going through where they need to go, and we get some of the great music here as this convoy is moving along, and we get a great shot of Nixon as he's going through there also. And then they cast like a small little shack, and as they're going past this shack, you hear a lot of yelling, and then you see three Germans being pushed out, with hands on their heads, and you see two soldiers standing behind them. Okay, now you probably know this better than I do, but I'm assuming that these are Russian soldiers, or
They're
am I wrong with
French.
that?
They're
They're
French
French.
soldiers, actually.
Ah, they're French soldiers. Okay, all right,
Yes.
that makes more sense. Because I was wondering, like, I looked at them, I was thinking that they were Russian soldiers, and I'm saying, what are the Russians doing here? So you're right.
Yeah,
Okay.
they're French soldiers. And in your later episodes, when you get to episode 10, your segments there, you'll hear more about the French again. It's kind of a race. The French are trying to capture a lot of territory. A lot of revenge killings going on the part of the French, obviously for a number of reasons, but nowhere near the level and brutality of those happening on the Eastern Front.
That's true. And then these French soldiers basically just execute these three soldiers along the way. And O'Keefe is shocked about it and looks back, trying to figure out what's going on. And the other guys, we see Perconte, we see Webster. They're not fazed at all. They've seen a lot of killing, O'Keefe is not used to this as the rest of them. And he looks at everyone as if they should be in shock. And, nobody is.
Yeah, they're wholly desensitized to the whole
Frank even,
situation.
right. Frank even shrugs his shoulders. They're like, what do you want from me?
Yeah, he's looking at him like, not my circus, not my monkey. You know, like I don't have to pay any attention to this. Again, they've been desensitized to this point in the war. They've seen their buddies killed. They've seen their buddies blown apart. This is the price of doing business. These guys brought it on themselves. You don't see they're not, whether or not they're SS or not, but there was an unwritten policy at times that they weren't taking SS prisoners. Not necessarily easy company in the 506, but as a general thought, especially after the fighting in the Ardennes, when there were a lot of American soldiers who were captured were murdered by the German captors, there was an unwritten policy that they weren't taking SS prisoners. So you can kind of understand the mentality there, but also you, the human in you, can probably not understand it. But you know, we're if you're not in that situation, you do you get to judge really?
Exactly.
Well, tough to say.
Right. And I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to remember who I talked to that mentioned it, but Band of Brothers is less brutal than the Pacific when it comes to showing what the atrocities of the Americans. And the what I was told at the time was is that one of the reasons was probably because, most of the most of the advisors for this series, were the men of Easy that were still alive. And, you don't want to besmirch them by showing them do brutal acts. But in the Pacific, where they're sh when they show it, it's mostly from characters who were no longer around. So,
Or were fictional characters that could, it was easy to write
exactly.
off. But if you'll notice in the Pacific, they set it up by showing the brutality of the Japanese soldiers. So it's kind of a quid pro quo relationship. And here you don't have that. And there was one particular Easy Company soldier who was very brutal and did murder prisoners. And I'm not gonna say his name. And it got a little of the kid gloves treatment. Going forward, but it did exist. You can't deny it, and you can't sweep it under the rug. It's a lot like Holocaust deniers. You can't ignore it, and you can't sweep it under the rug. It existed, it happened, and we have to accept it and learn from it.
Right, but do you
And
need to show it? That's the thing. And so here they're showing us the French are doing it. Not that this is necessarily what they did was an atrocity. I don't know. The question of but again, as I've heard from numerous people, what Don Mularkey has always said was is I will never judge anybody for something they did during war. Which makes sense. There's certain things that you can't understand. We can't understand why it necessarily happened. It happened, and you need to just take that as fact and move along, and not
Yeah,
necessarily take it when.
Don was always a very thoughtful individual when it came to what happened to him. I mean, he suffered from PTSD greatly, and it was very tough on him, especially later on in life. But you know, he was always very thoughtful, and I think sometimes the most thoughtful guys suffer the worst because you can be in your own head a lot. But I think in this scene, it's a much simpler idea where they just wanted to show the brutality of the war, but do it in a way that doesn't drag an easy company trooper into it. So you give this emotional topsy-turvy to the viewer. You make it kind of black and white, and it's easy to watch it because you don't see Frank Procconi walking over and shooting the guys in the back of the head. You know,
No,
there's
but you do see
unnamed
Frank
French soldiers.
Procanti's right. You see Frank
Right.
Procanti's reaction to it. That's the
Exactly.
difference.
You can demonstrate the desensitization of Frank in the scene,
That's right.
but also the sensitivity of the replacement in O'Keefe, and show the difference as what war has done to them.
That's right.
And again, just a brilliant job on all of them. And I believe his name is Matt Hickey. You got to give Matt a lot of credit too for a lot of that scene. Just he's speaking with his eyes, and he's managed to emote the proper level of shock. And then, what do we do? What do we do? Do we do anything? Nobody's doing anything. Or am I just supposed to sit here and watch this go down?
Correct.
And all of that is just it's spoken with his eyes and not with his words. And again, great work here on part of everybody
That's right.
to produce the scene.
Right. I mean, they even give us Leemgut's reaction where he just starts smiling
Oh, he smirks because
and
remember,
tossing a baseball. Yeah.
out of that group that's sitting in that truck right there, if you look at the actual veterans, Joe is probably the most bloodthirsty out of all of them.
That's right.
So the it's a proper response on his part.
Yeah, for sure. And again, he's just tossing a baseball, meaning that I really don't care.
No, I
Yeah.
could care less. It's just another thing that happened in the war.
That's right. Very true. And then they give us another shot of the trucks passing by, the dead bodies, and you see the French soldiers actually looting the bodies. You know,
This was
going through their
common.
pockets and taking, of course.
Yeah, it was common.
It goes back to our conversation about looting. There's a difference between, I think we talked about it on Friday with the, there's a difference between looting apartments and looting a dead soldier that you just killed.
Yeah, sure.
They do a nice job of just subtly showing to us what's going on in these types of situations.
Yeah, it's almost like a little bait and switch, right? You have the convoy moving in the background, the motion catches your eyes, but then these guys are right front and center.
That's right. And then we see the trucks enter into a small little town. You have all the trucks and the jeeps, and the whole convoy is coming in, and you see all the Germans not doing anything besides looking at them.
Yeah,
There
getting off the
isn't
road.
much they can do.
Yeah, getting off the road.
Getting out of the
Trying to
way.
figure out what's happening, what's going to happen to them. There's a lot of unknown there for them. They don't know how they're going to be treated. So it's cautious, their approach to just move over to the main intersection and then kind of gather up a little bit.
And then after all the trucks come in and they start getting off the getting out of their trucks and out of the jeeps, the Winters stands there with all of his officers, and he goes, "Well, I want to send out some patrols. We'll have dog here in the village, easy, and fox in the woods." And then Spears walks away and starts talking to his officers, and he goes, "Easy Company's going to take the Northwest. And Lipton, sir, have first and second platoons swing up into the woods. Have third swing around. Yes, sir." And then Lip goes and calls to Talbert, and he goes, "Search for Sergeant Talbert." So I like the way they show the hierarchy here. Winters says it to Spears says it to Lipton then sends the Talbert, telling him what he needs to do there and stuff like that.
Nice, neat little sequence showing the command hierarchy and in action, and that's a well-drilled maneuver. They all know what they have to do. There's no stuttering around or anything. Everybody gets right to it.
Correct.
And again,
And
all
then
those senior leaders are basically all Tocoa men. So they've all been together for a long time. They know how each other thinks, and they can react quickly.
And
So,
they've pretty much been in combat for almost a year at this point together, not just the training, and all that stuff. This is real world stuff, not just preparations and stuff like that. And Nixon then turns to Winters and goes, "You're not worried about an ambush, are you?" He goes, "Nope. But just in case, we have to stay here for the night." So again, it's a nice way to show how much caution Winters is putting in this situation. It's not something that they need to do, but he still wants to do it because you don't. Okay, I'm assuming that his instructions are to get to this little town, and that's it. He's told, "Okay, get to the town, and then we'll see what we're going to do from that point on." But he doesn't know if they're going to have to stick around or be moving forward or anything like that. So since we are here, let's make sure that we have the perimeter secured and that nothing comes and surprises us. Because again, we all know Winters will do anything and everything he can to keep his men safe. And
Yeah, they don't know how, like you said, they don't know how fast the lines are going to shift and whether or not going to be told to pick up and move out. So, I mean, but you also look at Winters, the character, and he's got his helmet on. He's leading by personal example. He's not saying, "Hey, it's still dangerous. Everybody put your helmet on." He doesn't have to say that. He's just going to put his helmet on, and he expects everybody to understand that if the battalion executive officer thinks it's dangerous enough to be wearing his lid, then maybe we should all put ours on too.
Okay, but what Welsh and Spears are still without helmets, as is Nixon.
Yeah. Well,
But then
yeah.
again, we've seen Winters as the example to everybody from throughout the entire series. He's the guy shaving in the middle of Bastogne when nobody
Yeah.
else is doing that, and because he knows that's part of military discipline, and that's what you need in order for your men to respect you. And respect the chain of command and everything like that. It's a hardship, but you're still going to do it.
Yeah, and but we'll see the this reflected down in the next sequence when we get to it,
Right.
as they go out on patrol.
Exactly. But again, it's a great little example of Winters once again showing how much he really cares for everybody and wants to do all he can to make sure everyone gets home safely. Or get as many men home as possible safely.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the back of everyone's minds at this point. It's the war's almost over. Let's not take any chances if we don't have to.
That's right. And then the shot changes, and we get a beautiful shot, actually, of the sunlight coming in through the top of the trees. We see the men on patrol inside of the forest. I think they're a little too bunched together.
They are bunched up, but obviously that's an affectation of the photography, right? They have to
Yeah,
have
of
them.
course. Because you have to have them have conversation without having to scream.
But you notice, at least for the most part, almost everybody has their helmet on. The guy who plays Joe Lesneski in the background doesn't have his helmet on at first, but he puts it on later on. So again,
And Bull takes his helmet off as they're walking.
for a second, yeah, runs his hands through his hair. When I had hair, I used to do that too. When I wore a helmet, I don't have that problem anymore.
Yeah, I don't have a problem either. You're right.
But and this is, obviously they have to have them bunched up a little bit so they can have the conversations they're going to have.
Exactly. And the conversation begins with Bull talking to O'Keefe. And
Yeah, I.
he goes, O'Keefe. He goes, Sarge. He goes, Why the hell are you so jumpy, boy? He goes, I'm not jumpy. I'm fine. I can hear your heart pounding in Arkansas, boy.
What's interesting sequence is, about that sequence is if you see the way the O'Keefe character is holding his weapon, that's a modern day carry. But because of where Bull is in the framing of the shot, he can't carry his weapon the way he would have been back then. So he has to point the muzzle down so they can get Michael Cudlitz into the shot.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, also Bull doesn't even have his hand on his gun at this point. If I was,
No. Resting in the crook of his arm on his cartridge belt.
That's right. Not necessarily. It's not the most difficult position to get it up if you need to, but you want those few seconds. You don't have to waste those seconds if you need it.
But that just indicates what kind of threat they think this is as well. Like they don't believe this. This is kind of a presence patrol. They don't expect to get ambushed here.
That's right. That's true.
And then we get to lean into Luz's sense of humor again.
That's right. And well, first Christensen says, Jesus Christ, give the kid a break, Bull. And then Percanti, the camera moves a little forward in the men who are walking, and Percanti goes, Hey, George, he goes, Yeah, this kind of reminds you of Bastogne. And he looks at him, Yeah, now that you mention it, except of course, there's no snow. We got warm grub in our bellies, and the trees aren't f***ing exploding from crowd artillery. But yeah, Frank, other than that, a lot like Bastogne. He goes, Right.
The
And then Luz
punchline.
goes, Bull, smack him for me, please. And then we'll just smack him a little bit. And he goes, Thank you.
Great sequence here, especially for the set dressing. The trees look excellent. I've spent a lot of time in that neck of the woods. It also looks a lot like the trees if you're in the Bois Jacques and looking up. And also, I also want to point out, the Big Red One. There was a sequence near the end of the movie where Lee Marvin, where the Kaiser character gets killed, And you have a lot of that looking up through the trees and getting the sunlight through it or the glaring through it. It's a lot of symmetry between the scenes.
Yeah, it's great. I really like the way they do this. Because it's also preparing us for what's going to happen over the next few days by showing
Yeah,
them walking through the woods, because they're not expecting to get anything in the woods here.
and being so tranquil as well. You know, like you're
That's
not
right.
expecting what they're going to end up finding. You kind of just think, oh, I'm just on another patrol. I just got to get through this, and then I'm gonna, we'll move on to the next thing, whenever that is.
Exactly. The rest of this segment is basically for us, for you and I, full circle back to what we were talking about on Thursday, right at the beginning, where here we have Beers walks into an office and just starts seeing what's going, seeing what's there, taking what he can, rifling through the papers, trying to figure out what's going on, and then we just get that for a few seconds, and then we get to see Nixon enter a house, and he's looking around for something. As I said, given that I'm talking about the fact that this is full circle, he's looking for booze. What else could he be looking for?
No, yeah.
This
You know,
way
the interest
he doesn't have to break, he doesn't have to break the window this time.
yeah, interestingly about this sequence, and if I remember correctly, and somebody will probably correct me at some point when if I'm wrong, this is actually something that was based on Major Winters' experience, not Nixon's, but they used the Nixon character for it, because again, full circle, the search for booze, it makes for an easy story to tell. But again, I think without saying a word, this is probably some of Ron Livingston's finest acting
Yeah,
as we go
he's
through
great.
this sequence.
Yeah, he walks into this apartment and goes, "Hello, hello." Nobody responds, but he sees that the record player is still playing. Which means that someone is around.
Either around or just left.
Or exactly. Someone
But
is not
notice
that.
he puts his pistol away, which means he doesn't, he's assessed the threat and he feels like there's no threat in the room, or at
That's right.
least nearby. But he sees the booze and he beelines right to it.
Yeah, he actually moves quite fast to get to the booth to see what it is. He smells it first to see if it's anything that's worthwhile drinking, and he leaves it. He doesn't take it.
Yeah, it's not his flavor. It's probably wine. He's probably like the functioning alcoholic. That's not going to do the trick. So,
That's right.
time to move on. But something else catches his eye then.
And then he sees a picture of he picks up a picture and looks at it, and it's a picture of a German officer. Again, you might know who this is supposed to be. I don't.
I do not. I
Yeah.
don't. I don't
Again,
recall.
it's the
I don't
idea is
recall.
okay. Again, the idea is that it's a high-ranking German official,
Yeah, very, very
maybe a general.
distinguished looking, Knight's Cross holder.
That's
So,
right. And then he takes it and just throws it onto the ground, and it breaks. And then he picks up another picture, a smaller picture of a woman. And as he's looking at this picture, the woman shows up behind him and comes into the room and just crosses her arms and just looks at him.
yeah,
And
glares at him,
that's
absolutely
right.
glares hate and daggers at him. Like,
That's
it's
right. As
just.
if, how dare you do this? And then Nixon just looks at her, isn't really sure how to respond, places the picture back on the table, and then just decides to walk by her. But the way that he walks towards her, you don't know 100% if he's going to walk by her or do something.
What's
They give us that slight question. Is he going to say something? Is he going to do something? Or is he just going to walk away?
if you look at the way he reacts when he folds up the picture and he puts it back on the table, what's really interesting is he has a look on his face that is not hate, and it hasn't softened either. He's somewhere in between, but he also is not taking his eyes off her because he's again assessing threat.
Right.
But as he comes by her, is this really interesting thing where he averts his eyes, and it's almost like he's ashamed of what he's done. And then as he gets to the door and he stops and he looks, he hardens back up again. And then the dog,
The
which
dog
is
starts
the,
barking at him.
but the dog is also the allegory, right? It's the, Remember, he was complaining about
Yeah, of
his
course.
wife taking the dog. So this is, and then you look at his face as he sees the dog. He's like, "Oh God!" You know, it's like this reminder that my wife who's divorcing me is taking my dog, and he's like, "Oh God, I'm out of here."
That's right.
This is just great moments. He's got these little singular moments in this long shot that he's working through. And again, not a word said. So full credit to Ron Livingston to get all that out without having to speak a single word in that sequence.
No, it's great. I love the way, I mean, he's one of my favorite characters, and I think Ron Livingston plays him so well. You know, he's a character who has his flaws. You know, like Winters doesn't have very many flaws, if any. You know, I guess the only flaw that people can say is that he's too perfect. You know.
He had a tendency to play favorites, and not in a way that you would think traditionally. Like people play favorites for advantage. He didn't do that. He had favorites because he could rely on them, because people were dependable to get, and he could get the job done. That's why he
That's
played favorites. Different from other people, like say Sobel, who had his favorites in First Sergeant Evans, who could use him to elicit certain responses from the men. Not all of them good. But anyway, he did play favorites, but not in the traditional sense.
That's right. And after Nixon leaves the apartment, we will get about 5 seconds of the men once again walking through the woods on their way somewhere that we will find out tomorrow where they're going or what
Yeah.
they're going to find.
Whoever your next guest is, and I'm sorry I don't know, but they're going to get a meaty episode to work through. That's really going to be a good one.
Yes.
But this one's been great. I really liked it. There were lots of, again, this episode 9, had a lot of subtleties in them, a lot of callbacks, and a lot of veteran inputs to it. So I really enjoyed it. And again, thanks for bringing me on to work through this with you.
No, I'm so happy that that we were able to find a time that works for both of us
Yeah,
to be able
this was
to
great.
get these episodes in. Yeah, for sure. I appreciate that. So, is there anything else you wanted to mention about this particular segment or Band of Brothers in general?
I'll say just for this last segment here, you'll notice during the filming, and you'll see it probably when you sit down with your next guest, it's very quiet. And I noticed the first few times I went to Bwajak, I didn't hear any birds, no insects, no birds. It was very eerie. This smacked of that, and it's a great setup for the rest of the sequence after it. As for Band, it continues to be one of my favorite pieces of television. 25 years later, we're all enthralled by it. We all love to sit down and talk about it, dissect it, just enjoy it. I revel in my experiences with the vets, and I still get a kick to hanging out with my friends who are actors on the miniseries. They're a bunch of fantastic people. They did a beautiful job of representing the men. They all care deeply about the men's legacies, and I find that refreshing these days. But it's been great. Thank you so much for having me. Your view, your listeners are going to really get a treat out of this, I hope. I hope I unloaded some information that they might not have had already, and they get something
I
new
have
out
no
of it.
doubt about that because you've enlightened me about things. So once you've enlightened me, it means you've probably enlightened everyone around also. So
Yeah.
I
Again, I
appreciate it.
appreciate you having me on.
Not a problem at all. And I appreciate that you were willing to do this because this isn't the normal format of what you usually do. So
Yeah,
there you go.
but you know, it's definitely enjoyable. You're sitting there dissecting a scene, only a 5-minute cut, and you've got a lot. It tends to make us give it a deeper look than we normally would, and
Exactly.
I really like that idea.
That's the point. That is the exact point. All right.
Well,
So,
then you're hitting home runs then.
So, Joe, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, everybody who's probably caught the other two episodes is probably sick of hearing me saying it. But yeah, please, if you're interested in learning more about Easy Company and World War II history, I have a World War II themed podcast called the We're Not Lost Private Podcast. You can find us on YouTube and Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Buzzsprout, and a whole host of other podcatchers. If you feel inclined to do so, give us a like and a share and subscribe, and I look forward to hearing from everybody.
All right, very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram, find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So, Joe, thank you once again for being a part of this. I really do appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure on mine.
All right, and I will be back tomorrow with another guest. But until then, curry!
Curry!